From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Waldman, President Clinton's former director of speech writing. Waldman wrote or edited almost 2,000 speeches for Clinton, including 4 State of the Unions and 2 inaugurals. He's written a new book called POTUS Speaks. Also, Andre Schifrin, in his new book, The Business of Books, he writes about how the literary world has been changed by the multinationals that now own many publishing companies. Schifrin is the founder of The New Press and the former head of Pantheon Books. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the changing meaning of the word community, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album by Queens of the Stone Age. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Hollywood movie executives appeared before the Senate Commerce Committee today to testify about the marketing of R-rated films to young people. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
The movie executives, representing 8 major studios, said their companies are committed to changing the way R-rated films are marketed to kids. Some of them said they would not advertise R-rated films on television programs likely to have large audiences under the age of 17 or on teen internet sites. But others argued that such marketing decisions should be made on a case-by-case basis. Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas asked how they would react if Congress regulated the industry. Warner Brothers Alan Horn had this response.
My gut reaction to what you've suggested is that it would be inappropriate and wrong for the government to involve itself in these issues of content and marketing of our movies.
All of the studio executives agreed that young children should not be used in market research on R-rated films. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Opposition demonstrators crowded central Belgrade today to demand that Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic accept his apparent defeat in Sunday's elections and step down. More than 200,000 people turned out to hear opposition candidate Vojislav Koštunica say he would not accept a runoff election after defeating Milosevic with more than 50% in the first vote. The Yugoslav Election Commission said yesterday that Koštunica won just over 48%, not enough to avoid a runoff. Opponents say Milosevic supporters rigged the vote count to give their candidate another chance to steal the presidency. President Clinton traveled to Dallas today to push for the passage of a national hate crimes bill. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports from Dallas.
President Clinton spoke at a Democratic National Committee Gay Lesbian Leadership Council luncheon at a private residence in Dallas. The president's tone was both optimistic and reflective. He pointed to the country's economic success, and he said he believed Americans had reason to be optimistic about the future. He urged leaders of Dallas's gay and lesbian community to continue to fight for equal rights.
Never allow yourselves to be marginalized or divided against your friends and neighbors. Because the progress we're making is because more and more people are identifying with our common humanity.
Clinton's swing through Dallas and Houston is expected to raise about $1.5 million for Democratic candidates. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
The White House has raised its estimate of the budget surplus for this year by $19 billion. The administration now projects that the government will have taken in $230 billion more than it spent this year. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 3 points to close at 10,628 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 32 points, or 0.9%. This is NPR News. Fox has won exclusive rights to air all postseason Major League Baseball games for the next 6 years. It reportedly will pay $2.5 billion to do so. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Until now, Fox and NBC have shared the rights to air league championship games and have alternated the showing of the All-Star Game. But under the new contract, Fox will have exclusive rights to show those games. It will also continue to air some games during the regular season. The new contract takes effect next year and expires in 2006. The contract is likely to be costly for Fox. The last network to purchase exclusive rights to the games was CBS in the early 1990s, and it lost money doing so. But Fox says it hopes to use the games to promote its other programs. Postseason baseball games typically attract the kind of large, heavily male audience that many advertisers prefer. Fox already airs NFL football games and will soon begin showing NASCAR races as well. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Federal health officials confirmed today that an 82-year-old New Jersey man died from West Nile virus, the first confirmed death from the mosquito-borne illness this year. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the man fell ill on September 3rd and died 11 days later. Last year, the virus was blamed for 7 deaths. Health officials say the virus can be fatal in the elderly, young children, or people with weakened immune systems, but most people who contract the illness will suffer only mild flu-like symptoms or won't know they've been infected. New Jersey officials say until the first frost ends mosquito activity, state residents should use insect repellent. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Clinton has a reputation for being more involved in writing his speeches than most presidents, often even ad-libbing at the podium. My guest Michael Waldman says this is true, and he should know. From 1995 to 1999, Waldman served as the president's director of speech writing. He started writing for the president in 1993 and joined his staff during his presidential campaign. Waldman wrote or edited nearly 2,000 speeches or policy statements for the president and worked with him on 2 inaugural addresses, 1 convention address, and 4 State of the Unions. He now teaches at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Waldman has written a new book called POTUS Speaks. POTUS is the acronym for President of the United States. I asked Michael Waldman what he considers the best speech he helped write.
There are a lot of speeches I was very proud of, but interestingly, for me, the speech I was proudest of was not one that was memorably eloquent, but memorably effective. It was the 1998 State of the Union Address. If you remember, that speech happened just a week after the world learned about Monica Lewinsky, and it was a crazy time. Nobody was sure whether he would be able to get up and do it. Nobody was sure what he would say. People speculated he might be resigning. And we were able to pull that speech together and very much have a huge impact on policy at a time of almost surreal pressure.
When you found out about the Monica story, what were your reactions about what the State of the Union Address should be? I mean, did you initially think he should say something about the allegations or that he should ignore that the allegations existed?
Well, once I got over my initial surprise, and it's worth pointing out that those of us on the White House staff basically had the same reaction to all this all along as most people watching. I thought that he should focus.
Which was what? You mean surprise?
Which was surprise and disappointment,
uh-huh.
But it wasn't something I was expecting.
Right.
The day before, I had seen a friend of mine who was the special counsel for the president who dealt with all these various investigations, and I had said to him, you know, this is the one week of the year that my job is harder than your job. And then overnight, the whole Lewinsky thing blew up, and I saw him, and I said, that's what I call one-upsmanship. I thought it was really important that he focus on policy, on his goals for the country. And if at all possible, he should find a way to not have to talk about the unfolding scandal in the State of the Union address. Now, if you remember, in the end, he spoke about it the day before, perhaps unfortunately, in answer to reporters' questions. But I really thought that it would be far better if he could focus on the work at hand. One of the reasons was I knew that if he'd said even one sentence about it, then that was what the press would focus on, that was what the headlines would be. And I think he was convinced to do that, and he wanted to do it that way from the beginning also. The reality is he had a lot he wanted to talk about that year on the budget deficit, on Social Security, and on other policies. It was as a matter of policy, it was a very powerful speech, and I think he knew that that was what would carry him forward.
Did you ever during that period ask him point blank whether the allegations were true?
No. For 2 reasons. One is, as we found out, people who asked that had to get lawyers. go before grand juries later on. And I'd been around the White House long enough to know that this wasn't just a salacious story in the press. This was a criminal investigation, and even innocent conversations among people were prone to being misinterpreted. But also, it would have been entirely inappropriate, I thought, for me to do that. I was trying to focus on the speech. And in my experience, to a remarkable degree, that was what he was focusing on, too. I remember just how tense the whole thing was when you drove into work. The camera crews were following you to see if you were anybody. And it was a sense of a White House under siege. And walking around the West Wing, every TV set was tuned to Mike McCurry, the press secretary's briefing, which was that day being carried live on all the networks, not just in the briefing room. And McCurry was being bloodied. You know, the reporters were asking question after question. And my pager went off in the middle of this. It said, call the Oval Office. And the president got on the line. And I didn't know what he was going to be talking about. And he said, have you read the memo from Stephen Carter, the Yale law professor? And I had read it 2 hours before, but even I couldn't remember what it said because of all this other stuff going on. And I said, yes, sir. Yes, Mr. President. He said, well, look on page 2. I really like the language about the idea of America and some rhetorical suggestions. I think you should use it, and I'll send it out to you. And we hung up, and I looked back at the TV set, and McCurry was still being pummeled. And it was quite amazing that at this moment of maximum peril to him and to the presidency, that at least at some level he was able to focus on the speech and on getting it done.
What do you think was most effective about the speech?
Well, in the middle of the craziness of the Lewinsky crisis, at his weakest moment politically, Clinton really was able to deliver his most effective speech. He got up there, and this was a line that he had worked with us to craft. He got up and said, we have a brand new budget surplus, which nobody had seen in decades. We have a new budget surplus. What should we do with it? I have a simple four-word answer. Save Social Security first. Well, the Democrats jumped up and applauded. They were applauding semicolons by this point. And Gingrich thought about it for an instant, and he stood up and applauded. And the Republicans in the Congress looked at each other and looked at him, and they stood up and applauded. And they had been determined to use the surplus for a tax cut, which would have had huge consequences. But at that moment, with everyone standing up and applauding on national TV, $1 trillion shifted in the budget from the column marked tax cut to the column marked Social Security. That's where it stayed ever since, and that moment has set the stage for this election and the budget priorities of the next several years at least. And this was the most amazing thing was about it. It was at the depths of the Lewinsky crisis. It to me, it was the most powerful use of the bully pulpit the whole time I worked with Clinton.
Let's talk about the most famous presidential speech snafu during the Clinton administration to date. And that was the time when the wrong speech was on his teleprompter. Tell us what happened.
In September of 1993, he went before the Congress to put forth his health plan for national health insurance. And somehow, the wrong speech got put on the teleprompter. It was the speech that he had delivered outlining his economic plan nearly a year before. And he got up there and saw that it was the wrong speech. And for about 10 minutes while they figured out what went wrong, he basically vamped and ad-libbed from memory and from having been in the middle of writing the speech, the first 10 minutes of the speech. And then eventually the teleprompter caught up. Now, I'm happy to say I wasn't involved in that particular snafu, but I was relieved at the same time because I had been responsible for my own snafu a week before that people really never heard about.
And what was that?
When the president launched his fight for NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, with Mexico and Canada, in the East Room, you'll remember he had President Carter and Ford and Bush there. And what happened was he was given a set of talking points or a speech that I'd written to choose from, and he chose to do the speech. But the folks who printed out the speech printed the wrong version of the speech. The first draft, rather with in a sense placeholder numbers, rather than the fact-checked final draft. And he went up there and read it, and I think partway through he realized what had happened. And I was there in the East Room, and I practically fainted. And later that day, we put out some corrections and told people that some of the numbers were wrong. And the press thought, we said it was a staff error, and the press was very skeptical, because how could it be, how is that possible that there could be an error like that? But that's actually what happened. But the reality is, nobody in that intense fight over NAFTA, the other side, never quite figured out what had happened. All I could think of was those movies of the early rocket launches where the rockets blew up on the launch pad, and that was what we were about to have happen. And so, as I say, when the mess-up happened with the teleprompter a week later, I was at least somewhat relieved that it had happened again more publicly than my own errors.
You were working with Dick Morris on one of the speeches for the president, and you had written something that Dick Morris then made slightly more concise and changed to, "The era of big government is over, but the era of every man for himself must never begin." And then it went through several other people's eyes who read it, and it was accused of being a sexist line because the era of every man for himself was male-gendered. What did you think? Did you think that that was sexist? Did you think that that needed to be changed?
At the time, I didn't see it that way. Although, when I tell the story now, enough people say to me that they thought it was sexist that maybe it was the right call. What happened was, Clinton always talked about his third way approach, not a traditional liberalism and not Newt Gingrich style libertarian conservatism. But a third way. And that was what the sentence that I had written and the more concise version that Morris suggested was trying to convey. And we thought that saying the era of big government is over would lead to a big ideological fight within the White House. But it was, in fact, the second half of the sentence, the era of every man for himself must never begin, was people said that was sexist. And so we spent days trying to think of what the second half of the sentence should be after the president, you know, basically agreed that we should change it. You're on your own, fend for yourself. We thought about all these things. And interestingly, the result was that when he got up and said the era of big government is over, the second half of the sentence was a very soggy, long clause. I don't even remember. It was something like, we must not go back, to go forward to a time when you're on your own and everybody is, whatever it was, it wasn't remotely as memorable as the era of big government is over. And that was what the headlines had, and that was what people remembered. At the time, I joked that political correctness killed liberalism, and it was an accidental homicide. It was one of those moments where you really realize that a president, with the way he talks about policy, can really set a tone and have an impact.
Did you run into those kind of gender problems a lot with language?
Interestingly, not really. It was something that you had to be careful about. Where it was interesting was President Clinton, like a lot of other speakers, often would like to go back to the founding documents, talking about the ideals for the country. Now, the Declaration of Independence said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We would usually paraphrase that, actually, to take the quote marks out and say we are all created equal, but not always. I think you have to be careful, but usually you can. Clinton was pretty deft about those things, and if we didn't catch it, he would.
My guest is Michael Waldman, President Clinton's former director of speech writing. He's written a new book called POTUS Speaks. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Waldman, and he wrote speeches for the president from his inauguration through 1999 and was the head of the speechwriting department for President Clinton from 95 to 99. Waldman has written a new memoir called POTUS Speaks. Now, you sometimes had to work in support of policy that you didn't really believe in. For example, you used to work with Ralph Nader's office, and you were very anti-NAFTA. President Clinton was very pro-NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement. And you had to work pushing NAFTA for a while for the Clinton administration. How did you feel about that, you know, working in support of a policy you didn't believe in?
It's true that I, coming into the administration, I had opposed NAFTA, and Clinton was for it. And I knew that when I voted for him and when I went to work for him. When push came to shove and they asked me to run the communications effort for NAFTA, it was a real dilemma, in some ways a primal loyalty test. And I decided that I supported him and he had made this decision, and I owed it to him to help him get done what he wanted to get done. I don't know if I would have thought that on all issues, but on that issue, that was where I came down, in part because I did think that he had put into the agreement labor and environmental side agreements, which addressed some of the concerns that I had. Now, I'll say that over the time, at that point and later, my own views on trade actually shifted somewhat. I think partly from working on that, maybe it was just convenient, but I came to believe that you couldn't go back on free trade, that you needed to find a way to make open markets work better for people, work better for labor and the environment, but that simply kind of retreating was not an answer. So by the end, I was more comfortable with it, but I ultimately had to decide whether to do it or to leave, and I thought I owed it to him to do it.
Why did you leave the White House in 1999?
Well, I'd been working for Clinton for 7 years. I had three young children, and it's tiring. And so I wanted to see what was next, do some writing and teaching, and move on.
It wasn't because you felt betrayed by, say, the Monica Lewinsky story or anything like that?
No, I was even thinking of leaving before that. As it's such an exhausting experience. People are always wondering what they're going to do next. But I stuck it out during that time, in part because I thought it was important to stay there.
Now, what was it like watching President Clinton's convention address in August and not having worked on it yourself?
It was interesting hearing it fresh and being in the position with the rest of the audience. I thought it was a wonderful speech. People at the convention center were congratulating me for it, and I hated having to tell them I had nothing to do with it. I thought it was great to see him make an argument where he wasn't the candidate. I think that added to its effectiveness.
Remember he had that line in that speech, and people were divided about whether he was saying, whenever you think of me, or whatever you think of me.
At the very end of that speech, he said, I thought he said, whatever you think of me, don't stop thinking about tomorrow. And like a lot of other people, I thought that was a very deft way of saying, you know, put your feelings about me aside and focus on the record and on Gore. It turned out that he didn't say that. He said, whenever you think of me. A lot of people are feeling very betrayed by that. But the fact is, he said it, I guess, the way he said whenever. I think a lot of people liked it better the other way.
Was it written as whenever or whatever?
Yes. I asked the speechwriters, I said, which line was that? And they said it was whenever. Well, I think actually it may have been ad-libbed. I don't think it was really some big thought-through strategy.
How did it change your writing to have written for the president?
When you're writing for a president, you have to try and write in his voice. If I wrote a speech and people said, wow, Waldman, that was great, it really sounded like you, then I'd failed. So I'm a New Yorker through and through, and probably have some of the smart-alecky tendencies of a New York writer, and had to learn how to write in a more mellifluous Southern voice. And I think over time I'm recapturing my own my own style. We'll see. I'm sure it improved it. I learned an incredible amount from Clinton, from his knowledge of history and scripture and all those kinds of things. And, you know, I hope that benefits me in the long run.
I bet you weren't used to quoting scripture.
No, this was one of these. Neither I nor the other speechwriters were very good at giving him the scripture passages that he liked. And when Ron Brown's plane crashed, that was very emotional and dramatic for all of us because we'd known him or knew the people on the plane. The president rushed up to Alma Brown's house, and we got a call from Alexis Herman, who was then on the White House staff, saying, you know, the president's going to go to the Commerce Department in 20 minutes. Can you write something up for him? And we said, well, sure, but did or does, this is one of those moments where you don't know what tense you're supposed to use. Does Ron Brown have a favorite Bible passage or hymn? And she said, yes, da-da-da-da-da-da, gotta go, click. So I wrote it down, but we didn't know if we'd gotten it right, what it really was, and we didn't have much time. We scrambled, we thumbed through Bibles, it was like a joke. We called rabbis, priests, and ministers. We looked on the internet, and we couldn't find it. So we had no choice but to just put it in the speech and go over there. President Clinton came in, and we went up to him, and one of my colleagues handed him the speech and said, Mr. President, here's some remarks you could use. There's only one problem. There's this Bible quote here, and we don't know if it's a real Bible quote. And Clinton looked at it and said, oh, Isaiah, this is the New English translation. I prefer King James. I prefer King James. That's what I'll use. And he got up and sort of blended the translations and improvised a whole eulogy around this. And, you know, none of us could have done that.
Well, Michael Waldman, I thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Michael Waldman is President Clinton's former director of speech writing. Waldman's new book is called POTUS Speaks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup, with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, SaabUSA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books, publisher of Yoga and the Quest for the True Self by Stephen Cope, now in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, publisher Andre Schifrin talks about how the literary world has been changed by the multinationals that now own many publishing houses. Linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on the changing meaning of the word community. And Ken Tucker reviews a new album from the hard rock band Queens of the Stone Age. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bowling Alone is the title of a recent book by Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam, which argues that community participation is in sharp decline. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg finds this striking in light of the explosive growth in the use of the word community itself.
The title of Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, is a reference to a curious recent trend. While more Americans than ever are going bowling, there's been a sharp decline in bowling leagues over the same period. For Putnam, the tendency exemplifies a much more general decline in participation in American civic life. PTA membership is down in recent decades, and so is membership in the Elks, the Kiwanis, and B'nai B'rith in the NAACP. All of these are signs of what Putnam describes dramatically as the collapse of American community. But if it's true that Americans have less of a sense of community than they used to, it certainly hasn't stopped them from using the word community more widely than ever before. Of course, the word has been used for centuries to refer to groups that are drawn together by some common circumstance that sets them off from the people they live among, the merchant community, say, or the British community in Naples. In the 19th century, English Jews referred to themselves simply as the community, which is pretty much the same way that gays and lesbians use the phrase today. But alongside of these more or less traditional uses of the word, you find it applied to just about any group of people that share some property or interest, however incidental it may be. Do a search and you'll find references to the Rottweiler community, the Windows community, the vegetarian and vegan community, and the video arcade game collecting community. I ran into a regional transportation plan that talked about accommodating the needs of the pedestrian community, a group I've communed with myself from time to time. And this is not to mention the left-handed community, the asthma community, the bail bond community, the piercing and tattoo community, and the diaper community, which, in case you're curious, is a branch of the infantilist community. Then there's just the community in the abstract, which is the term we apply to society when we want to paint it in a warm and deserving light. Expressions like community service, community relations, give back to the community, all of them have the positive connotations which are a defining trait of the word, however it's used. Whatever else it may be, community is good for you. Nations, states, classes, regions, those are all things that can sometimes make us nervous when they exert too strong a hold on people's allegiances. But nobody ever complains about an excess of community feeling. And just to ensure that community remains an absolute good, we withhold the word for any group that we disapprove of. Not long ago, I heard a speaker at an AIDS conference say, "We need input from all the affected communities, the gay and lesbian community, the minority communities, the intravenous drug-using community." That one stopped me in my tracks. You don't usually hear drug users referred to as a community, nor do you hear people talking about the terrorist community or the Holocaust denier community. It isn't that the members of those groups don't have common interests or convivial interactions, but for us, they aren't bathed in the glow of warm sociability that the word community evokes. Though, of course, this all depends on your point of view. A phrase like the pedophile community sounds pretty weird to me, but it turns out that pedophiles use it all the time. The explosive growth of community began long before the Internet age. It got its first modern boost from the sociologist who popularized the word in the 1920s and 1930s, around the time the American public first started to take social science seriously. Among other things, that was when housing developers began to exploit the term. And it enjoyed a further boom in the 1980s, with a rise of an identity politics that defined everybody by their differences. But it's only with the Internet that the word has achieved its current promiscuous versatility, as it becomes possible to organize a national conversation around any common interest or concern, however etiolated it may be. And like the housing developers of the 1940s and 50s, web developers have been quick to perceive a commercial opportunity in the new uses of the word. Software companies offer tools for building high-traffic community around a website or a new video game, and most commercial sites have what's called a community page, where people can gather to commune about Campbell's Soup or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Software makers are in hot competition right now to develop community portals that are specialized to the needs of everybody in the farmer's insurance community or the purchasing agent community. Community is on its way to becoming one of those commodified American virtues like heritage. You can buy it by the yard. There's something about the word community that ought to make us nervous. It's not just because of the rosy light it casts, but because it's hard to see how there could be much meaning left in a word so elastic that you can use it to wrap anything from an ethnic group to a bunch of people who like to exchange soup recipes online. Maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing if it was finally stretched so thin that it snapped.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Coming up, the business of books. This is Fresh Air. In the new book, The Business of Books, Andre Schifrin writes about how the literary world has been changed by the conglomerates that now own many publishing houses. Five major conglomerates now control 80% of American book sales. These changes have directly affected Schifrin's life. He was the longtime head of Pantheon Books, which his father co-founded. Pantheon was later bought by Random House, which was bought a couple of years ago by the German conglomerate Bertelsmann. Schifrin was forced out of the company in 1990 after refusing to make cutbacks and other changes. In 1992, he founded a not-for-profit publishing company called The New Press. Some of the conglomerates that now own publishing companies also own movie and TV companies. I asked Andre Schifrin how book sales compare with profits from the other media.
Right. Well, that's in a way one of the problems, because books are really a relatively small percentage of the sales of these very large corporations. Overall, for the country as a whole, we sell about $21, $22 billion worth of books a year, which is, you know, like a seventh and an eighth of the time AOL annual sales altogether. So book publishing is still a relatively small industry in comparison to the other media holdings, and not that profitable a one, which is, of course, a major problem for the people who belong to conglomerates, because how are they going to get investments from their owners? How are they going to get enthusiasm when all they can do is come up with a very piddly amount of money at the end of the year?
So how has this affected the amount of profits that book publishing companies are expected to make, those publishing companies that are now part of conglomerates?
Right. Well, that's the key to the change in publishing. For most of the century, publishers really made, you know, 4, maybe 5% on an average. It was like having a savings bond or an ordinary savings account. And people went into publishing for all sorts of reasons, but making a big amount of money was not the major reason. And that 4 or 5%, by the way, is the average from the most commercial to the most esoteric firms. Nowadays, the large conglomerates understandably expect to make as much money from publishing as they do from the other holdings. So they want 15 to 20%. And, of course, tripling, quadrupling, quintupling the amount of profit that you get is very, very difficult, and very few of them have been able to do that and to do it successfully. But they've try to alter the nature of publishing so as to allow for that kind of increase.
Do you ever wonder why international conglomerates want to buy book publishing companies in the first place if the profits usually aren't that great there?
Well, there are all sorts of reasons there, and a lot of this is mythology, of course. I remember once asking a friend who was very high up in the Time Warner world and said, how did the people who owned the firm go from rent-a-car and funeral parlors, which is where they started, to movies? And he said, oh, well, they wanted to be in a business with dames, at least live dames. And in a way, that's a little bit, publishing has always had that appeal, not necessarily genuine sex appeal, but the appeal of something more picturesque, more interesting, and, of course, the illusion of synergy, the idea that if you own a publishing house, you can then get the movie rights and so on to the books that you publish. That's what led Miramax, for instance, to set up Talk and Talk Books, the idea that you'd have a kind of synergy, that the books would turn into films. And, of course, that's relatively rare, and there are agents involved and so on, so things don't quite work out. I mean, I don't really see, you know, the latest Talk bestseller, Martin Amis's memoirs, you know, turning into a long feature movie about Martin Amis's teeth. I think it's hard to do that. But there is that illusion. And, of course, the other factor is that the foreign firms, like the German firms, want to get out of German. They want to get into English. That's the world language. That's the language of the future. And so they're willing to take huge risks to buy into the U.S. And the two major German conglomerates, Holzbrinck and Bertelsmann, have moved you know, many, many billions of dollars into the U.S. in order to do that.
So do you think that international conglomerate ownership of American publishing companies is affecting what is published here?
Oh, absolutely. There is an enormous change, and I've tried not to be hyperbolic or just to go on my subjective feelings, and I've looked at the catalogs. I've looked at the catalogs for 1950, 60, 70, and 2000 for the major firms, and there's a chapter in the book devoted to the changes that have taken place among just the three biggest firms, and it's replicated throughout the industry. And it is really unbelievable. I mean, even I was shocked when I looked, for instance, the Harper catalog for 1960, 1950 was really incredibly impressive. They had dozens and dozens of history books, of books on philosophy, on theology, on art criticism. They published some of the major authors of our time. And, you know, but so did Simon & Schuster and so did Random House to a lesser degree. If you look now at the catalogs of those firms, you just don't see those books. They've disappeared.
What do you see instead?
Well, you see pretty much what you see on the bestseller list and what you see in the bookstores. That is, you see a lot of would-be bestsellers, the Stephen Kings and so on, that we all are familiar with. You see still a lot of fiction that people hope will be commercial, but you don't see any of the experimental or foreign fiction that these firms used to publish. You see a lot of how-to. You look at the Harper Collins catalog, they have something called Harper Entertainment, which had last year 136 volumes, including, you know, the Jerry Springer picture book and so on and so forth. You know, that comes from a firm that used to publish the major history and theology and so on of our time. So the shift, if you put those catalogs side by side, is pretty phenomenal.
What about the place of independent publishing companies and university presses? And the independent companies and the university presses stand outside of the conglomeratization of publishing.
Right. Well, you know, one of the sad things about writing this book is that increasingly the examples that I give of marvelous independents who are still doing a good job, you know, changes with every month. So that the number of the traditional firms, the older firms that are independent, is really dwindling. There are very, very few of them left. On the other hand, and it's an important and encouraging sign, there are a lot of new small firms being started, mostly by very young people throughout the country. I remember going to Minneapolis the other year for a meeting with a bunch of independent publishers, and there were four of them that were based in Minneapolis, and they were run by young people, some of whom had been corporate lawyers, and others who decided there was more to life than simply making money, and they wanted to try the traditional kind of publishing. So I find that very encouraging. And of course, these firms are increasingly coming up with a larger and larger percentage of the interesting and important books.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andre Schifrin. He's the former managing director of Pantheon, and he's the founding director of The New Press. He's written a book about publishing called The Business of Books. Your father was in publishing. He was born in Russia, went to France after World War I, began his career as a publisher and translator there. He worked with André Gide on translations. But after the German invasion of France, he was forced out because he was Jewish. You were about six at the time when your family left the country and then eventually wound up in the United States. In the U.S., your father joined a new book company called Pantheon, and that's the company that you ended up working at for, I think, about 30 years. What was the goal when your father joined Pantheon, when it was a brand new company?
Right. Well, Pantheon started in 1942, really as an exile publishing firm. It was started by Kurt Wolff, who was a very distinguished German publisher who had published Kafka and so on in Germany, and who had also been forced to leave because of Jewish ancestry in his family. And they started publishing books in German as well as in English. And then my father had been publishing books in French, books from the French Resistance, books that were being published clandestinely in France. And so the original books were really attempts to show to Americans that there was a culture, there was a politics going on during the Second World War, even under the German occupation, that they should know about. But after a while, Pantheon, you know, developed titles that did much better in the U.S., and eventually they were to publish Dr. Zhivago and The Tin Drum and a number of other books that became huge bestsellers. So it was an attempt at the beginning to fill the gap, a very real gap that existed in wartime America, about what was going on in Europe, what had gone on in Europe. And then, you know, at times, it doesn't always happen, but virtue was rewarded, and they got a lot of bestsellers that made huge successes.
Now, as an example of the fact that takeovers in publishing is nothing new, Pantheon was purchased by Random House back in 1961.
Right.
Do you think the company changed by that takeover?
Well, Pantheon at that stage had finished a first stage. The Wolfs, who were the chief editors, had left. It was sort of in limbo, and it was very profitable because of the books they had brought in, and the stockholders figured this was the time to sell out and make some money, which they did. But what was interesting in the takeover is that Random House didn't just amalgamate it or make us part of Knopf, as Pantheon now is. They said, no, do what you can. Start off on your own. See what you can publish. See what a new generation can do with this kind of heritage. And, you know, I was all of 26 at the time, and because I suppose I was so young, it didn't occur to me that this was a crazy thing for anyone to entrust a publishing house to someone that age. But Random House was incredibly supportive, as I say in the book, and we were able to publish, I think, some of the most important books being published from Europe and from the U.S. at the time, ranging from Michel Foucault and Noam Chomsky and Gunnar Myrdal and so on, a list of which I'm very proud to this day. But it wouldn't have been possible if Random House initially hadn't been that supportive. And that was, you know, the difference between then and now. They were willing not to make any money for a while. They were willing to let the company grow. They were willing to see what young people could do. And they were marvelously supportive. Bennett Cerf and Don Clough and the other people I write about. Nowadays, when you buy a firm, you fire the staff. You keep the backlist insofar as it's profitable, and you more or less destroy its identity. When HarperCollins bought Morrow and Avon the other day, they had 200 people on staff. You know, they got rid of 120. No one even mentioned it anymore. It didn't even make a paragraph in the Times. It's just taken for granted.
You know, the business of business is usually to make money. And you're criticizing publishing for being too involved now with the goal of making money at the expense of bringing out the books that you think companies ought to be bringing out. Why should publishing be different from any other businesses and pay less attention to the bottom line than any other business?
Right. Well, you know, the idea of profit maximization is, on the whole, you know, a relatively new one. It's now that everybody is on the stock market and that everything is globalized, that you're competing all the time with how much money can you make if you invest it in China rather than here, and so on and so forth. But in publishing, there's also the fact that if you're going to look to the future, if you're going to develop authors, if you're going to find new ideas, new people, you have to take these risks. And if you don't, it's not going to work. And one of the interesting things is, if you look at what happened to Random House in the last years of New House and to HarperCollins and so on, they made less money than ever. When Random House was finally sold to Bertelsmann, their profit was 0.1% that year, and they'd written off $80 million worth of books that they knew would never earn back their advance. So it's not necessarily even good business. But even if it were, you know, I think publishing, like radio, like TV, has a kind of social responsibility. We're not licensed by the federal government, and nobody would ever want that to happen. But there are a lot of programs that help publishers that come from public monies, whether it's library purchases or school book purchases or cheaper postal rates and so on. As with all print, the assumption since the revolution has been that the dissemination of knowledge is something that is worthy of government support in that respect. You know, publishing has gone very far from betraying that trust and, in a way, betraying that investment.
What's one thing you understand now about authors that you think you didn't understand until you wrote your book?
How oversensitive they are. You read every review, you know, with your teeth clenched and worried about it. It makes a difference whenever you get a phone call from somebody who says, you know, I just read your book and I agree with what you say. I've always tried to encourage and praise our authors and occasionally to hide a negative review from them. But I've learned, I think, this way, how very sensitive you are about anything you've written.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it was a great pleasure. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Andre Schifrin is the founding director of The New Press. His new book is called The Business of Books. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by the hard rock band Queens of the Stone Age. This is Fresh Air. Queens of the Stone Age are a California band with a new album called R, as in the movie rating code for restricted. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the band pulls together its hard rock music from a wide range of often contradictory sources.
Someone recently told me that his summer guilty pleasure was going to see the teen cheerleader movie Bring It On, because he's not a teenager and he knows it's cheesy. Queens of the Stone Age started out as a guilty pleasure for me because its CD is all adolescent melodrama and I ain't no adolescent, and because it's full of cheesy guitar riffs. But they're big, well-played cheesy guitar riffs, so I've decided not to feel guilty about this pleasure. Really, it takes talent to come up with stuff that stupid that sounds this good. Meet Queens of the Stone Age lead singer-guitarist Josh Homme, who, Rolling Stone magazine reports, often greets audiences by saying, "Hello, we're not angry and we don't rap." Not that Homme has anything against rap, it's just that he's a 20-something in love with the sound of buzzing guitars as heard on 20-year-old records by artists as various as Lynyrd Skynyrd, David Bowie, and Black Sabbath. In fact, Queens of the Stone Age are currently touring as part of Ozfest, the hard rock tour for stoner kids headlined by Sabbath's old geezer Ozzy Osbourne. Josh Homme and his band make hard rock with elaborate structural ambitions. His best compositions unfurl with grand flourishes, and the crunchy riffs that keep his grandiosity witty, not merely pretentious. On the CD jacket, he subjects each Queen's song to his own rating system. SE for subversive elements, D for disbelief, R for revenge. These prove generally to be more incisive than the ones Jack Valenti's henchmen give to movies. Hailed as great post-grungers, the band sounds to me like guys who want to extend the tradition of divine stupidity of 70s punk bands like the New York Dolls and the Dead Boys. Most intriguing thing about Queens of the Stone Age. I bet if you heard each of these songs on this album at different times, interspersed over a period of time on the radio, you'd think they were each created by a different group. Except for the lead singer's calmly crazy voice, the tunes have very little in common with each other stylistically. Yet the album hangs together as a work of young men bent on cracking the secret code of harsh rock and roll. Or, to use a different metaphor, I think this CD contains the DNA for a strain of rock that will carry heavy metal into this new century as a new monster.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed R by Queens of the Stone Age. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shirock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Megan Howell, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I've got a secret I cannot say.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Vintage Books Division, paperback publishers of Plain Song, the new novel by Kent Harriff. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a look at the secret deals that were made or nearly made during the impeachment process. We talk with Washington Post reporter Peter Baker. His new book, The Breach, is based on post-impeachment interviews and documents that had never been made public. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.